From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When the president used his inaugural address to vow an end to tyranny worldwide, the global reaction ranged from sympathy to amusement to fear. But with the surprisingly successful elections in Iraq, media around the world disseminated and absorbed the images of courageous, ink-stained Iraqi voters and began to reconsider George W. Bush's ambitions. Joining us once again is Martin Walker, editor-in-chief of United Press International, with a review of the reviews from last week's election and Wednesday's State of the Union. Martin, welcome as always.
Hello there.
If we're to believe the president in a State of the Union address, democracy in Iraq and the rest of the Middle East is all but a fait accompli. Reading the European and Arab press, do you think there's a consensus on that issue?
Not altogether. What's very striking is that the Europeans seem to be moving in George Bush's direction. Le Monde, which is the great French newspaper, which has been exceedingly critical of the Bush foreign policy, said, should we celebrate these elections? Yes, absolutely, without any reservation. We mustn't forget, Iraq had never known free elections before, not even under their monarchy. Although these polls took place in the worst possible conditions, nonetheless, the people of Iraq tried to vote. In Belgium's The Standard, it looked like the mission impossible, and yet the first phase has turned out all right for Mr. Bush. Iraqis chose to vote because freedom is the wish of all people and not just a Western value. The success of a system of freedom in this Arab country could become a beacon for the rest of the region. All across Europe, we're getting this from Germany's Berliner Zeitung. The courage of the Iraqis to vote and the surprisingly high turnout demonstrates, above all, a rejection for the terrorists, but it also demonstrates that perhaps President Bush has been right.
Isn't this a complete U-turn?
Well, some of the papers are putting in, obviously, a certain kind of caution. The Guardian, the liberal left paper of Britain, when a nation holds its first elections after a long period of dictatorship, the temptation is to rejoice at the mere fact that it's happening. In many respects, it's difficult to be confident this was a free or fair election, given the violence and intimidation surrounding it. Nor do we have any idea when the grim nightmare of violence will end.
Wild guess here, Martin. I'll bet the euphoria does not extend to the Arab media.
No, it doesn't. You're entirely right. Al-Quds Al-Arabi, which is based in London, it's a pan-Arab newspaper, to talk about democracy in the light of bloody chaos that is putting Iraq upon the rack is a complete fraud. Bush's congratulations cannot reflect the reality of Iraq, only his own obstinacy and his attempt to conceal the failure of the American imperial plan. An editorial in the Saudi paper Al Jazeera, Iraq is blazing a path of fire which the Americans entered by force, not knowing that the situation was far, far more difficult than they thought. From Al-Sharq Al-Awsat, Palestinian-owned, printed and based in London, this election will be remembered for being the first in history in which most of the candidates did not dare to reveal their names.
One powerful symbol that emerged from the election in Iraq a week ago was the purple ink-stained fingers. They were used as evidence that you had voted, and they were indelible so that you couldn't vote repeatedly at multiple polling stations. But people brandishing those fingers, they became a symbol, certainly in the Western media, for nascent freedom in the Middle East. Was nobody moved in the Arab world by that fairly stunning bit of symbolism?
Yes, they were moved, but not in the direction which I think you're intending. For example, Palestine's paper Al-Ayam, where they too, of course, have just gone through their own election recently. History in Iraq and the neighbouring region will change after the elections, just as President Bush predicted, but not in the way in which he thought, just as our own elections will not change the Middle East in the way in which he thought. After all, it is clear now to all Arabs that Bush intends only to take control of the central government of the Arab states, despite their elections, and to take control of our oil, leaving the Ayatollah Ali Sistani and his like just a paper autonomy that will turn Iraq into a chicken cage. So damn this supreme democratic ideal.
The president was relatively bellicose in a State of the Union address towards both Syria and Iran, and gave some words of caution to our allies Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Has anyone in Europe yet registered nervousness about the president's tone?
Oh, yes, Germany's Die Tagesschrift Zeitung. We have the right to feel a chill down the spine to describe Bush as a madman with a mission at the head of a state bristling with weapons. Doesn't begin to describe the full terror of the case, but it doesn't get us very much further. And from Turkey's Milliyet, which is the best-selling newspaper in the country, they are very worried. They're saying, quote, as the strategy of toppling Saddam Hussein and democratizing Iraq has gradually turned into a nightmare scenario, the initiative of declaring new wars and attempts to widen the occupation increase our suspicions about Bush's second term. Out of the websites of some of the Iranian papers, they're not taking his threats very seriously. From the Tehran Times, there simply aren't any American troops available to invade Iran. But what might tip the area into acute crisis is a re-radicalized Iran that is concluding it will never be secure until it's expelled the United States from the entire region.
Well, that was a fairly hard line. Was there any softer line taken elsewhere in the Iranian media?
Well, what's interesting is the moderation of one of the sort of semi-official papers, the Iran Daily. The Islamic Republic of Iran cannot remain immune from mounting US pressure. In the face of a new round of warmongering policies and propaganda warfare, Iran needs to adopt a comprehensive approach based on boosting transparency and international trust without compromising its national interests.
Martin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is editor-in-chief of United Press International.
Ladies and gentlemen, with grateful hearts, we honor freedom's defenders and our military families, represented here this evening by Sergeant Norwood's mom and dad, Janet and Bill Norwood.
And the applause went on, and then it happened. The military mom and the new Iraqi voter seated directly in front of her reached across the seats to hug. It was the dramatic highlight of this year's State of the Union address, and along with the wagging of purple fingers, the Democrats' uncharacteristic boo, the speech itself, and the Democratic response, it was all fodder for the pundits who gathered for the ritual of post-event deconstruction. David Brock, a self-described ex-conservative and founder of the liberal watchdog group Media Matters for America, did some quantitative analysis of TV's post-speech punditry. Specifically, he told us, his group tallied the cable news network's talking heads according to ideology.
The most striking result was that on MSNBC, you had a real disproportionate mix in terms of guests. You had 11 conservative guests and only two progressives in the 7 p.m. to 12 a.m. time slot, whereas in comparison, CNN's coverage was much more balanced, and Fox's was even better than MSNBC's.
Well, did the pundits represent, say, a wide variety of views within the parties, or did they just represent the extremes, or what?
There didn't seem to be a wide diversity of views within the conservative perspective. For example, there is conservative division on the war, but you didn't really hear that.
And what about on Social Security?
One of the things we looked at in terms of the Social Security debate was language that's used by the media in terms of describing the president's program. We had three specific examples from MSNBC where a host and two reporters were using personal accounts terminology rather than privatization. So clearly there's a trend line toward the media conforming somewhat to what the Republicans at this point prefer to call their program. This has been an ongoing controversy back to 2002 when Republicans, apparently as a result of their polling, decided that privatization wasn't a popular term, and they started to shift the language toward personal accounts.
It'll be interesting to hear what the reporters do with the new phrase that was presented last night by Harry Reid in the Democratic response when he referred to something as the birth tax. That's a new bit of liberal rhetoric that I'm sure he's hoping will eventually take over.
Yeah, that was actually interesting because I think for the past few years, there's been a lot of progressive attention to the reality that conservatives have succeeded in many ways in branding their programs more successfully than progressives have. And so, for example, the death tax, the birth tax that Senator Reid referred to seemed to be an effort to do exactly that, to try to create a phrase that might be evocative and then might echo through the media to make a point more clearly than in some cases progressives have been able to do in the past.
I wonder if you're doing a little bit of rhetoric management yourself, David. I mean, mostly we use the term liberal. I know that you like to use the word progressives. A lot of people do on the left prefer to use the word progressives because liberal has become a pejorative.
Well, I think that's right. I think at least going back to the Clinton administration, Democrats, many Democrats anyway, have started to use the word progressive as opposed to liberal, and that seems to be the accepted language at this point on the Democratic side.
So let's go back to the State of the Union's most signature moment, I guess, which was the hug between the mother of a Marine who had died in combat and an Iraqi woman who had the opportunity to vote for the first time. There was some debate, I guess, whether that was spontaneous or stage managed. What was the general view from television?
Well, I think I did see on MSNBC that that question was raised by Chris Matthews, who was suggesting in a kind of skeptical way that a lot of things in politics are choreographed. I don't think anybody knew that that was the case, but that was some speculation. And then Ron Reagan Jr. was the only one I saw, although I couldn't watch all six simultaneously, who raised a question about the tastefulness of using really emotionally loaded moment to make a political point. But of course, you know, that's been going on for years. I think the Reagan White House is really credited with beginning to do that. And so that was the only place I really saw that discussed.
You know, it's funny because David Korn, writing in the very progressive Nation magazine, said here was Bush's story of sacrifice, liberty, and freedom. Sentiment, sincere sentiment, was in full sync with spin. So do you think it was generally perceived on television to have been a great successful moment with a minimum of naysaying?
Overall, yeah. I mean, I think that on the theatrics of it, there was unanimity that it was a very effective speech. In terms of naysaying, you know, one thing we noticed was that the factual claims of the president really weren't contested very much across all the cables. During the presidential debates, the cables all ran fact-checked segments. After the State of the Union address, there didn't seem to be an awful lot of fact-checking going on in terms of the president's speech, but much more commentary about the style of the presentation.
Does it leave you with hope for the American media establishment, or not so much?
I think not so much. Something really needs to be done to address the consistent imbalance where you just don't hear strong progressive voices very often on these cable channels. And even though the cables have lower ratings than the networks, they do have a highly influential and politically attuned audience. And I think that means the playing field isn't yet level.
All right. David Brock, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
David Brock is founder and president of Media Matters for America.
Coming up, incendiary, wildly popular, and very unprofitable. Is Al Jazeera up for sale? Also, the meaning of mainstream media and crossing swords over crossfire.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, BrandChannel.com released its annual survey, which found that Al Jazeera is the fifth most influential global brand in the world. 9-year-old Al Jazeera has built its reputation both on commanding millions of Arab viewers and on running afoul of nearly every government with interests in the region. But its success has not translated into profitability. The news channel has always been subsidized heavily by the Qatari government, and this week Qatar hinted that it may be trying to privatize Al Jazeera. Much of the U.S. press reported this as the direct result of American pressure on Qatar, but it's unclear who a privately owned Al Jazeera would really benefit. Adil Iskander is the author of Al Jazeera, How the Free Arab News Network Scooped the World and Changed the Middle East, and he joins me now. Adil, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
What has the relationship been between Al Jazeera and the Qatar government?
It's in the benefit of the Qatari government to portray Al Jazeera as an independent station as far as editorial policy is concerned. But at the same time, the station itself is primarily the brainchild of the Emir of Qatar and has been funded quite heavily since its rise in 1996. There's been talk about Al Jazeera's eventual financial independence from the Qatari government. It was actually brought up 14 months ago, but that really hasn't happened at all, which has raised speculation both among Arab audiences as well as governments in the region, in addition to the U.S. administration, about the true independence of the network.
Tell me the nature of Al Jazeera's independence. They have clearly built an audience, but they don't have a lot of friends in government offices, do they?
No, absolutely not. In fact, Al Jazeera has recorded close to 450 official complaints from governments both in the region and outside of it. Now, that's also paid off for them as far as audiences are concerned, audiences who are generally quite skeptical of media organizations in the region who are generally owned, operated, sponsored, and regulated by the local governments. Audiences look at those complaints with the governments in the region to actually mean that the network does have some degree of independence.
However successful Al Jazeera has been at attracting an audience, that has not necessarily translated into the kind of advertising revenue that enables it to operate profitably.
The real hidden force here behind Al Jazeera's failure to consolidate advertising funds are really the Arab regimes in the region. Most of those governments have intricate and intimate relationships with advertisers, both Western and regional, and they have essentially created a boycott of the network. Now, it hurts advertisers as much as it does Al Jazeera. I mean, with Al Jazeera's audience ranging around 40 to 50 million, you would think that advertisers would go there. But they also are having to deal with the restrictions and the potential boycotts of their produce by the governments in the region.
There's advertisers who won't buy a spot on Desperate Housewives. How will multinationals, for instance, react to a cable channel that is perceived as glorifying terrorism?
Some multinationals will probably take the risk. If Al Jazeera can meet a principled journalistic code of ethics that multinationals can agree to, even though they do have some of the inflammatory rhetoric that they do, then I think there may be a comfortable middle ground where both can profit. Had it not been for the Arab governments in the region and preventing advertisers from buying commercial spots on the station, most of those multinationals would have probably gone to Al Jazeera.
So Al Jazeera apparently is on the auction block, but if Arab governments have been successful at keeping advertisers from advertising on the satellite channel, what are the chances that someone is going to come forth and put in the billion-dollar bid required to buy the thing bag and baggage?
It's not on the block just yet, but the issue here may be the fact that Al Jazeera or the Qatari government is sending out a feeler. I mean, this news juxtaposed with the story about Al Jazeera being one of the top most recognized brands in the world may actually give Al Jazeera leverage and set it forth on a new corporate path. But I think it'll resonate quite differently with audiences in the region. Many of them might start questioning the funding of Al Jazeera. I mean, who are the shareholders? Who's providing the money? Audiences there are generally quite skeptical anyway.
Let's just say that this isn't just a trial balloon and that the Emir of Qatar really has decided that the cost, both the $40 million a year subsidy and the political cost of continuing to underwrite Al Jazeera just is too great. And let's further assume that nobody steps in to fill the void. Then what happens to Al Jazeera?
I would be surprised if the Emir would let it go. He will probably take it under his wing again. If in reality, the reason behind this initiative is the constant pressure of the U.S. administration, then it will have to go under a new level of scrutiny. But I don't think the Emir of Qatar would be prepared to give up on his brainchild just yet.
All right. Well, Adil, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
Adil Iskander is author of Al Jazeera, How the Free Arab News Network Scooped the World and Changed the Middle East.
Every so often, we consider words or phrases that percolate up through the media. And one locution that has lately been breaking the waves is mainstream media. An old term with a new hot-button status, the supposed decline of the mainstream media is a favorite topic of Fox News star Bill O'Reilly, who invokes it here in an interview with PBS's Michael Medved on The O'Reilly Factor.
What do you think is going on here inside the mainstream media? You're a talk show host, and you do that, but inside the CBS's, NBC's, ABC's, do they know there's a culture war raging and how they're handling it?
Well, they're beginning to. But part of the problem is they don't get the religiosity of the American people.
That's one variant in the meaning of mainstream media, a cauldron of left-wing ideology paradoxically out of touch with an increasingly conservative mainstream. Author Bob Kahn, staunch critic of the New York Times, put it this way. On the O'Reilly Factor.
You know, the mainstream media has had a monopoly over the setting of the news agenda for over 30 years. And now with the advent of talk radio and TV cable, cable news like the Fox News, they don't have that monopoly anymore.
In his formulation, mainstream media, or MSM, does not refer to Fox News, America's most watched cable news channel. New York University journalism professor Jay Rosen, who authors the blog PressThink.org, says the term is fatally imprecise, and he's coined his own, legacy media, like the legacy airlines.
Well, they resemble the legacy airlines because they are, in a sense, saddled with an outdated or heavy infrastructure in an age when to be nimbler and lighter might be a lot better.
You conceded in your column that the airline industry's legacy carriers have been pretty much given up for dead.
Right.
Do you forecast the same fate for the MSM?
No. But I think they have to realize that adapting to a new world is critical now. And that certain notions, certain standard practices, things they've lived with, grown up with, might in fact be tossed overboard. The philosophy of objectivity and neutrality now has to be stretched over like conflicts in politics that are so deep that the one hand and the other hand reporting, he said, she said, it's like a escape from truth rather than a measured tone of truth, a kind of a silence that journalists have practiced, that others are now filling in.
We know the networks are mainstream media. We know the newspapers are mainstream media. But
right.
How about cable? Or is it everybody on the one side is mainstream media and bloggers, the citizen journalists, the independents on the other side are not the mainstream media?
When I use the term, I mean the professional culture of the press as it extends over a lot of different media outlets. But it depends on where you are in the media food chain, what you mean by mainstream media, that has a lot to do with it. It's a term to designate an other, and especially in blogging, that's what it is. It's the other. It's what you're reacting against. It's also what you're reacting to.
It's them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as a word, it's essentially a moving target.
Floating signifier, we call it, in the university, yeah.
And possibly even a product of an increasingly paranoid culture, because it seems to me that it's almost always invoked as a pejorative.
Associations with cluelessness do cling to this term.
Cluelessness, but also extreme capitulation on the left or the right. I mean, when Bill O'Reilly refers to it, he talks about a liberal media establishment that's not only out of touch but pernicious. And when people on the left talk about it, they talk about one that is wholly owned by corporate interests and the right and is antithetical to the goals of democracy.
You know, Brooke, as we're talking about this, it's occurring to me that part of why this term mainstream media came about is that a lot of different people could say what was ending. The world of the mainstream media began unraveling in the mid-70s. When cable television began to enter American life, and this limited range of choices started to expand dramatically. And the internet came along and took all of those people who for so long had been the audience of the media and connected them to one another. For the year 2004, for people on the cultural and political right, the red state of America, MSM was a very concrete, real, almost sensuous thing. It was not at all an abstraction. And I think people are going to remember 2004 and the politics of that year partially with those initials, MSM.
New York University professor Jay Rosen authors the blog PressThink.org. As we reported last month, one of the first moves taken by new CNN president Jonathan Klein was to cancel the network's signature shout fest, Crossfire. In so doing, he explicitly allied himself with the show's most famous detractor, comedian-turned-social critic Jon Stewart, who turned an October appearance on the show into a biting critique.
It's not so much that it's bad as it's hurting America.
Granted, there were probably non-ideological components to Jonathan Klein's decision. The show's ratings had plummeted since its primetime heyday. Nevertheless, Klein is being hailed for the move in editorial pages ranging from the Chicago Tribune to the Augusta, Georgia Chronicle. CNN Washington Bureau Chief David Borman summed up the reaction when he told the Washington Post that, quote, there was a sense that Crossfire had developed into people asking each other if they still beat their wife.
On the left, Paul Begala. On the right, Robert Novak. Because they should vote for all of them.
He says the Constitution says advise and consent.
He says that, but he says the president should be entitled to the people he wants.
At least one pundit doesn't agree that this model of political debate is hurting America. Michael Kinsley, one-time host of Crossfire and current opinion and editorial editor at the LA Times, wrote a fond eulogy for the show, and he joins us now. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Brooke.
So I get the impression that you were annoyed by the vigor with which your colleagues jumped on the funeral procession.
Canceling Crossfire is not, you know, the worst thing in the world. But John Klein, who is doing a lot of interesting and good things at CNN, sort of agreed with John Stewart about it, which was a little unseemly while he was sticking in the knife, I thought. And I think that the genre of shout fest, as you call them, has some value.
So then how would you respond to John Stewart in this criticism?
Well, let me say a few things. First of all, do you still beat your wife is a pretty good question. You know, you have to make a question that'll force the politician to say something interesting. And, you know, a question where any of the obvious alternatives leaves no good escape is a good question, because he or she will either have to say something interesting or flagrantly avoid it.
Okay, so then let's continue this conversation in true Crossfire style. Now, on the intriguingly contrarian yet vaguely self-interested side, Michael Kinsley. And on the sanctimonious, not of the real world side, Bob Garfield. In the Crossfire, Crossfire, threat or menace? The former host says that Crossfire penetrated the American public in ways that more nuanced media can't. The holier-than-thou outsider says that the adversarial format of Crossfire crowds out complexity and degrades the national political discourse. Is the end of Crossfire good or bad for America? Garfield?
It's good for America. Michael, you've been the host of Crossfire. I've been on the show exactly once, but the whole time I felt like Jimmy Swaggart in a whorehouse, caught up in the excitement, but dirty, dirty, dirty all at the same time. It's not just that complex social policy issues are distilled to cheap theatrics and a few bumper sticker one-liners. After all, that's how political discourse is mass marketed in this country. The point is that journalism should be about getting beyond the trivial sloganeering. It should be seeking genuine understanding, not pressing hot buttons. The sin of Crossfire was that it was so busy playing to an entrenched opinion that it failed to enlighten anyone. Rock'em Sock'em Robots is a good game, but it's a game for children.
Well, Bob, first of all, democracy is conducted on many levels. And, you know, I've worked for many years at the New Republic magazine, and I'm now at the Los Angeles Times editorial page. And, yes, you get more thoughtful, more detailed analysis there. You also reach fewer people. On a show like Crossfire, you are appealing, at least in its heyday, to millions of people. It's like a shot right to the heart of the body politic. You have to deal on a different level. Not everybody reads the New York Review of Books or the New Republic. And if you give up at any attempt to reach people directly, I think you're not playing the game of democracy, which is a very good game.
It's interesting you should use the phrase a shot to the heart of American democracy, because, as we both know, a shot to the heart tends to be fatal. But let me change metaphors. You seem to be suggesting that because it's palatable, it's therefore has some level of goodness. You know, some parents can't get their kids to eat broccoli, so they give them potato chips. I say that's not good parenting. Me, I just exposed my kids to broccoli earlier, and they love broccoli. And by the way, they read the New York Times.
Well, you're fortunate in both of those, but we can't live on broccoli. I think Crossfire, in some ways, was more intellectually honest than other shows that people find more respectable. On Meet the Press and these formal interview shows, you have to pretend that you're totally objective and you're asking someone questions. And then on the shows, which are sort of panel discussions, you have to pretend that you know everything. When I worked on Crossfire, I felt very comfortable that I was asking questions, but at the same time not having to hide my viewpoint. And that seemed more honest. There actually wasn't all that much shouting on Crossfire. I think what politicians like to dismiss as shouting was relentless pressure on them to answer and follow-ups that prevented them from answering with nonsense. And that creates a lot of tension.
Oh, isn't it like you pundits to just oversimplify? Well, you know, Michael, vanilla extract isn't vanilla. Oh, it tastes and smells good. But it's just a distillation that exaggerates and, Michael, ultimately distorts the actual bean's intrinsic quality. You can ask the questions, but if no answers come forth, haven't you just given the public vanilla extract?
I'm not sure I follow the metaphor.
Yeah, I'm frankly lost too.
But I think the Crossfire method actually extracted more information and true views from politicians, or exposed them more clearly for evading the answer than other shows. And I think that that was a strength, not a weakness.
Tomorrow's topic, Bob Novak, threat or menace? Michael, thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome, Brooke, and I look forward to that one tomorrow.
Michael Kinsley has edited Harper's and the New Republic, founded and edited the online journal Slate, and written columns for the Wall Street Journal, the Times of London, and the New Republic, among other things. Since 2004, he's been the editorial and opinion editor for the LA Times.
Coming up, a recipe for Superman. Take two gangsters, add geeks, and stir.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women, and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 10 years ago, there were dire predictions of the death of the comic strip. Dwindling newspaper readership and the looming shadow of the internet were the main reasons cited. And then there was the retirement of three of the medium's biggest stars: Gary Larson of The Far Side, Bloom County's Burke Breathed, and Bill Watterson of Calvin and Hobbes. As Watterson left the building, he grumbled there was no point continuing because the glory days of the comic strip were long gone. What a difference a decade makes, as OTM's Benjamin Walker reports.
The Reuben Awards are to cartoonists what the Oscars are to Hollywood, and last year the Reuben for Best Newspaper Comic Strip went to Pearls Before Swine.
It's got a rat and a pig, a very mean rat at that. They don't move, they don't show expression, and they talk about death a lot. So the odds of Pearls succeeding were slim.
That's Stefan Pastis, creator of Pearls Before Swine. He may be laughing now, but just a few years ago, the idea that a strip like Pearls could find a place on the comics page and win the Reuben as well, in less than 3 years at that, really was inconceivable. The comics page has never been a friendly place for cutting-edge or even contemporary humor, and not even the star power of Larson, Breathed, and Watterson could change this. But after 1995, after the big three retired, things actually got worse.
When newspaper readership started to decline, editors turned the wrong way in many places, and they became more conservative. They began to only buy strips that had a set demographic, and by that I mean, here's a strip for women under 20. Here's a strip for Hispanics. Here's a strip for people on the right side of the political scale. And I think what got lost was, how about just a strip that's, you know, supposed to make people laugh?
A lot of strips fall into certain genres of, this is a family strip. This is a work strip. I'd like to think that my strip is about how we are when we're not in those roles. How we are is just kind of an individual navigating the world.
That's Hillary Price, the creator of the comic strip Rhymes with Orange.
My aunt had once told me that nothing rhymed with orange. I felt that the strip was something different on the comics page, and I felt that the title would reflect that.
She started in 1996, and yes, her syndicate did push her as a cartoonist for the young woman demographic. 10 years later, she is still the youngest female syndicated cartoonist. But today, her strip appeals to many different groups of readers. One of the main reasons Rhymes with Orange and Pearls Before Swine stand out on today's comics page is because the majority of the strips are old. Really old. The Lockhorns, 1968. Blondie, 1930. Snuffy Smith, 1919.
I mean, could you imagine nowadays in the movies if Gone with the Wind was still playing in movie theaters, if Milton Berle was still on in prime time, if Bob Hope was still at the, you know, Sunset Comedy Club? I mean, it's absurd, and yet comics, that's where most of comics is.
One of the things I try to do all the time is to make the strip relevant, at least in the sense that the language and the topics and the imagery is colloquial. It's not sort of stuck in the 50s.
Darby Conley is perhaps the most successful cartoonist of the new generation. His strip, Get Fuzzy, is in over 500 papers and is the fastest-selling strip in comics history. At first glance, Get Fuzzy looks like an updated version of Garfield, a mean cat, a dumb dog, and a hapless owner. But Darby's changed the formula.
You know, you try to phrase it delicately, but I really try to make it funny. Like, I try to make a joke in there rather than just a little sort of aw moment or something like that.
Darby Conley, Hillary Price, and Stefan Pastis are part of a revolution that is not only creating a new generation of comic strips, but a new generation of readers as well. So how did this happen? Well, every cartoonist I spoke with credits the African-American cartoonist Aaron Magruder and his Japanese manga-style comic strip Boondocks that exploded onto the comics page in 1998. Aaron Magruder could not make time to talk with us for this story. His assistant said that he's too busy with the Boondocks television show. According to an April profile in the New Yorker magazine, these days Aaron literally phones in the jokes to an assistant who does all the drawing. The comic strip has always competed with television and Hollywood for new talent, but 10 years ago, another player emerged, the internet. Today, lots of people are reading the comics on the web rather than in the newspapers, and this is something that worries all the cartoonists I spoke with.
The only way that cartoonists make money is by the number of papers that they're in, not by their internet presence. So if you learn about the cartoon by seeing it in the Globe and then you look at it online and then the Globe cancels it, there's not a lot of incentive for you to call up the Globe and shake your fists at them and scream and cry and that kind of thing.
Even though Stefan Pastis echoes Hillary Price's concerns, the internet, he says, has played an undeniable positive role in the revolution taking place on the comics page.
No internet, no pearls. I mean, I only got in papers because the internet convinced them that Pearls was viable.
In 1999, Stefan's syndicate put Pearls Before Swine up on its comic site, comics.com, to see what would happen. It started out with about 1,000 hits a day, but then Dilbert Scott Adams endorsed Pearls to all his fans in his newsletter.
And in one day, I went from 2,000 hits to 75,000 hits, and the next day, I think I had 130,000 hits. So that helped. And because of its internet following, they decided to put it in newspapers, and that has since sort of become the model.
But with all this talk of new models and new types of humor, is there a danger of losing sight of why comics are beloved by millions in the first place?
I think more and more there's strips that are mean-spirited and cruel and more edgy, as they say.
That's Patrick McDonald, the creator of the multi-Rubin Award-winning strip Mutts. McDonald's Mutts just celebrated its 10th anniversary, making Patrick the older, wiser brother to this new generation. McDonald believes that while brash, in-your-face edginess can be funny, it is also something extremely difficult to sustain, and that all the great comic strips have a rhythmic, almost poetic edginess that's lasting.
The people that I've admired could still be printed in the paper day and still be, I think, considered modern. I mean, when I read Popeye or Crazy Cat or Charles Schulz's Peanuts, I see comic strips more as poetry, and I think the really good ones have a timelessness to them.
Every large bookstore now has a well-stocked graphic novel section, and animated movies and television series are doing better than ever. And thanks to this new generation of newspaper cartoonists, the comic strip, the heart and soul of the comics art form, isn't going to get left out of the Renaissance. For On the Media, I'm Benjamin Walker.
The comic book actually began life as a bound collection of comic strips. But that happened, as the philosopher said, long ago in a galaxy far, far away. Actually, on the Lower East Side of Depression-era New York, the product of Jewish immigrants who had tried just about everything else. Their names were Harry Donenfeld and Jack Liebowitz, who slid into comic books from even more dubious publishing ventures in soft porn. But Jack and Harry would have gone nowhere without the help of two other men, kids really, in the generation just behind them. Short, nearsighted, nominally middle-class geeks before geeks were called geeks, their names were Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who pooled their fantasies and came up with Superman. Gerard Jones is the author of Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book. He starts his tale with a portrait of Harry Donenfeld hustling his way through the roaring 20s.
He'd sell ladies clothing, he would run errands for mobsters, he would do whatever he had to do to survive on the Lower East Side in the early years of the 20th century, and found himself through a family connection in the printing business, and from there found himself in a perfect position to import Canadian whiskey during Prohibition and hooked up with the Frank Costello organization, because Harry was buying paper from Canada and he had warehouse space, and it was very easy for him to bring the stuff in, after which he also found himself able to tap into a large distribution network. There was this shadowy distribution network through America in the 20s, a lot of which was fueled by illegal booze, but it also carried contraceptives and it carried girly magazines, which was Harry's particular passion. And into his life came Jack Liebowitz, a fallen socialist, son of a socialist organizer, who got a CPA degree in order to work for the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union and went through a crisis of faith in the 20s, which I think was largely about the fact that the union was so infiltrated also by the mob during those same years. So Jack found himself, instead of setting up the strike fund for the workers, found himself skimming money for Lepke Bookalter and his friends. And Jack broke with the union and ended up as the only CPA in the girly magazine business as Harry's partner.
And from girly magazines, they went on to publish spicy crime and detective mags and, trying to stay ahead of the vice cops, finally, comic books. But now let's expand on the inclusion of the word geek in the subtitle of your book. The geek was born when science fiction was born, and that happened in August of 1928 in a comic book called Amazing Stories.
Yes, actually it's a pulp magazine that had a picture on the cover of a spaceman lifting into the air from his suburban lawn, and it was an image that seized the imaginations of 13 and 14-year-old boys, mostly boys, across the country. And that magazine, Amazing Stories, helped stitch together really the first pop culture fandom as we've come to understand it. There were fans scattered everywhere, reaching each other by sending letters to the other kids they saw in the letters pages. And one of those was Jerry Siegel, who was growing up in kind of a middle-class suburb of Cleveland. His dad had made enough money that Jerry could afford to go up in his attic bedroom and draw pictures and type stories on his typewriter and read pulp magazines, whereas guys like Harry and Jack were hustling on the Lower East Side. And so he and other geeks like him began to send out their own stories. And among the ideas Jerry had, along with a friend of his, an artist named Joe Shuster, was this idea of the alien visitor who has powers and defends us from crime.
So it's really these two generations that gave rise to the comic book. The publishers were the children from these mean streets, and the inventors of the characters were from these softer environments. And the publishers, it seems, brutally exploited the inventors.
As the story's normally been told, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were naive kids who didn't know their rights, who sold them away to Donenfeld and Liebowitz and were treated coldly and cruelly thereafter. In fact, I found that there were several times when Jack and Harry tried to sit down again and keep Siegel and Shuster happy. But Joe Shuster, the artist, really just wanted to go off in his own world and draw and left all the real world work to Jerry Siegel. And Jerry, unfortunately, had his own sort of superheroic fantasy. He wanted to seem like a hustler and a big shot. But in fact, he was floundering. people would tell him, you know, you should get a lawyer for this, Jerry. And he'd say, I don't need a lawyer. I know what I'm doing. It is a tragic story in that the boys, the creators of Superman, ended up in poverty and ended up having to go public with their losses. But I think there's a particular, almost classic quality of tragedy in that you see so many places where they might have done better, as did the creator of Batman, Bob Kane, their peer. He knew to get a lawyer and go in and negotiate with Jack Leibowitz, and he got a very good deal on Batman. Poor Jerry and Joe just kept shooting themselves in the foot. Jerry, by the age of 60, was working at the Public Utilities Commission as a mail clerk, scrabbling for occasional comic book freelance work. And finally, when the Superman movie came out, when it was announced in 1975, he decided it was time to go public, and he launched a campaign trying to shame DC, which was then part of Warner Communications, into giving him some credit and some recompense at last.
Did he get it?
Oh, I hate to blow my ending, but let's say it's not an entirely tragic ending. It's a Greek tragedy with a modern happy ending, yeah.
Gerard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gerard Jones is the author of Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book.
Other enduring comic book heroes that have followed Superman onto the silver screen, Spider-Man, the X-Men, Daredevil, and the Hulk, all created or co-created by comic book legend Stan Lee. Taken together, they've earned hundreds of millions of dollars for Marvel Comics, and not a little resentment from Stan Lee himself, who didn't appreciate being Jerry Siegeled. Lee sued the company he helped build for a piece of the action, and last month the U.S. District Court ruled that Lee is entitled to 10% of the profits from Marvel's film and TV productions. Marvel plans to appeal. Last Wednesday, Lee spoke with Bob Simon of 60 Minutes about the lawsuit and about his relationship with Marvel, where after six long decades with the company, he remains chairman emeritus.
Don't forget, I've written about superheroes all my life, and they're the good guys. And they always do the right things. And I always thought our company is the good company, and we always did the right thing. And we always tried to treat the artists and the writers and the editors well. And suddenly, I felt I wasn't being treated well. And it really hurt.
That was Stan Lee last Wednesday. We last spoke to him 2 years ago in a happier mood after Marvel came up with a new backstory for one of his most durable characters, The Thing, one of the Fantastic Four. As Lee wrote it, The Thing was born Benjamin Jacob Grimm, working his way through life in New York City's Lower East Side before the encounter with cosmic rays that transformed him into an ugly but lovably heroic piece of rock. Though The Thing has been part of the Marvel Comics universe since 1961, it was not until August 2002 that we learned he was Jewish. Quite a surprise for us. But Lee said it was news to him, too.
I wanted to write four superheroes. One was a girl, one was a handsome guy, one was a teenager, and I wanted the fourth one to be something different. I never thought for a minute what their religions were.
But now that we think about it, it suddenly all makes sense.
The Fantastic Four, starring Reed Richards, Stu Richards, Johnny Storm, Ben Grimm. Reed Richards with his power to stretch. The Thing with the strength of 1,000 men. Johnny, flame on, torch. The Invisible Girl. The Fantastic Four, united in their fight against interplanetary evil. Fantastic!
As Galacticus hatches a plot to enslave the universe, Ben Grimm, the Thing, stirs from his slumber. He can feel the force of evil vibrating in his granite musculature. And he is getting a message from far away.
Benny, Benjamin, it's your mother.
Impossible. You died when I was a child. I was raised by Uncle Jake and Aunt Petunia.
Excuse me. You took a rocket into deep space and got yourself transformed by cosmic radiation into a Fakakta metamorphic mesomorph, and you don't think your own mother can talk to you from beyond? And by the way, you look a little jaundiced. Have you been eating leafy vegetables?
Ma, I'm a mutant. I'm orange.
Listen to the big shot talk to his mother, Mr. Superhero with a Shiksa girlfriend. To the Mole Man, you wouldn't take this tone. Or Dr. Doom, who, by the way, has made something of himself. I always told you, podiatry, it's a gold mine.
Mom, I gotta go. Galacticus is wreaking havoc on the universe, and it's clobbering time.
All right, Thal. Bundle up.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Ann Kosseff, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Arun Roth, Susanna Dillaplane, and Nicholas Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media, produced by WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the New School in New York City, offering an interdisciplinary graduate program in media studies. Fall application deadline March 15th. Information at nsu.newschool.edu/PRI. Also from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James R. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.